Thank you. Thank you, Your Excellency. It's hard to believe. We first did this 6 years ago, and it was a little experiment, and then we repeated it 3 years ago, and I'm delighted to be here again. We call it the Literature Seminar, and it is indeed primarily for the seminarians to help you learn about life. Great literature is the best way, I think, short of hard experience, to learn about life. And just as it's good for a pilot not to get in a plane right away and try to fly, they put him in a simulator and he can do test runs. Literature gives you some test runs at life so that you don't necessarily have to make the mistakes, find everything out the hard way. And when it's at its best, it's written by men of great wisdom who have either the experience or the knowledge to tell profound truths. As a result, it is worth the time. And for the rest of you who are laymen as myself, it's something to cling to as the world goes madder day by day. The last two times I gave a kind of background, introduction to literature seminar, what is literature? Actually, in our private moments, we call it the book camp. I prefer that. It's summer. It's a kind of summer camp, and it's about books, so I prefer book camp. But I'm not going to do that this time because I will get into it very quickly in talking about the Canterbury Tales. The title of the work itself makes clear that it's a work about tale-telling. So that one of the things we're going to be examining as we look at this work will be what the nature of tale-telling is, why people do it, what they learn from it. So I will get into all of that as I'm actually discussing the work. Let me give you a rundown, just some things you need to know in terms of schedule. I only have 2 weeks. Usually when I'm teaching a full semester, I have 16 weeks, and I never stick to a schedule then. It's something of a joke among my students. I try, my intentions are honorable. I've not yet ever stuck to a syllabus. But I will tell you my intentions for the next 2 weeks. Today, Tuesday, and Wednesday will be the Canterbury Tales. It's a massive work. It's a Catholic work. And I think well worth that bulk of time that we will spend on it. Thursday and Friday, the early Shakespeare comedy, A Midsummer Night's Dream. In fact, I have a radio broadcast tomorrow night, and I will be doing it from the office upstairs via the phone, talking to 2 to 3 million people. And I'll be talking about Midsummer Night's Dream, so they'll get a little first go at it before I start it out with you on Thursday. But basically this week, Chaucer and Shakespeare. The Canterbury Tales, Midsummer Night's Dream. I will then begin David Copperfield, massive book, huge book, long book, the greatest read ever put down. That's my own autobiography rising up, and I'll bore you with that next week when I start it. In any case, Copperfield, Monday and Tuesday, it may spill over into Wednesday. And then sadly, not a lot of time, but probably one day on Emily Dickinson's poetry, one day on Eugene O'Neill's Long Day's Journey into Night. There will be at least two films, maybe three, but those will be next week. So this week, if you have extra time, read and try to stay up with what we're doing or get some sense of it. The one major project you might want to embark on is get into Copperfield a bit, because I think it will be helpful if you're at least well into the novel. And I don't want to spoil the plot. It's the worst thing you can do with a wonderful story is, and I do have to talk about it. And I really would dread ruining the story for you, because part of the joy of reading that book is the joy of great literature. What happens next? Where is all this going? So if you get a chance, dive into that. And over the weekend, read furiously. Fortunately, it is a page-turner. I think once you get into the rhythm of it, it goes quickly, and it is hard to put down. That's the schedule coming up. But starting with Chaucer, and again, because of time limitations, I will just give quick biographical sketches for most of these writers. But let me put Chaucer in context. He was born, we think, this is not absolutely clear, 1343, midpoint of the 14th century. He dies in the year 1400. In order to keep this in your mind, I think this is helpful. Dante sets the Divine Comedy in the year 1300. Chaucer dies in the year 1400. Shakespeare produces Hamlet in the year 1600. So those are good milestones if you just want to keep in mind sort of where we are and what things are happening. Dante, the Divine Comedy, 1300. Chaucer, Canterbury Tales, 1400. That's the year of his death. Shakespeare produces Hamlet, 1600, 200 years after Chaucer. He came from a fairly well-to-do merchant family. So that they were a prominent family, had some wealth, and as a result of their prominence and his great promise, he began to serve the wife of Prince Lionel in the year 1357, very young man, still in his teens, and at that time met John of Gaunt, who was the father of the future King Henry IV, very prominent, very powerful man in England. He served as a soldier in 1359, when England invaded France. He went as a soldier, he fought there, he was captured by the French, and ransomed in 1360. So he spent close to some months in captivity. Came home, he married in 1366, his wife Philippa. They had four children over the course of their marriage. And in 1367, because of the good work he had done, he was already beginning to be known as a writer. He was given a royal pension. The government began giving him some money so he could pursue his writing. And they began sending him on diplomatic missions. The most important gift they gave him as a diplomat is they sent him on two occasions to Italy. Early in the 1370s, late in the 1370s. And while in Italy, he immersed himself in Dante, Boccaccio, and Petrarch, and came to know Italian literature very well. Because of his time in France, he knew French literature very well and spent some time translating some of the major French pieces into English. And then he did the same with some of the Italian writers, making translations, but there were other influences as well in terms of broadening his understanding of what could be done with literature. In 1374, he was made the controller of customs on wool, skin, and hide, any of it coming into the country. He was the one who would oversee it all. And then an even better deal in 1382, he became the controller of customs on the wine trade. So that all the wine that was brought into England, he had final say over. It's a job one could dream of. It's like Shakespeare's father in Stratford, who for a while was the official ale tester of the town. It's just, you know, these are jobs a man dreams of having. In 1386, he became a member of Parliament, served in Parliament. His wife died in 1387. In 1389, Richard II made him the clerk of the king's works. What it basically meant is that he oversaw the maintenance and repairs of bridges and parks, so that he was overseeing throughout all of England. I mean, it was a very prominent position. What's astonishing is he's writing at the same time. He held these government positions, but simultaneously did a good deal of writing. In 1391, having been in charge of overseeing the parks, he became, and I love this title as well, the Royal Forester in Somerset, and he had a particular forest that was his charge, and he served at the command of the king, and therefore he was a royal forester. In 1394, 6 years before his death, the king gave him a life pension, so that for the rest of his days, money would come from the court so that he could support himself, no longer have to work, and could turn out his works, basically spend his time, devote his time to writing, which is why we suspect the majority of the works come late in his life. It's when he finally had this time, because it was the time was paid for, that he was able to write. 1395, Henry IV had taken the throne, son of John of Gaunt. Chaucer, Geoffrey Chaucer, had known the father, the son again, very kind to him. He was in attendance at the court, favored by the king, and the king increased his pension. So that the last 5 years of his life were very comfortable ones. honored in the court. It's the sort of thing that, well, we'll see not happening to some other writers, okay? But in this case, a very successful man, highly honored, and spending his last years at the court, supported by the king, honored by the king, and allowed to write. Now, having said that, there is a great sorrow, and that is that the Canterbury Tales is an unfinished work. It seems odd, if you look at the length of it, to understand it's a fragment. He never completed it. In some ways, I like to think of it as one of those great, magnificent medieval cathedrals that would take generations to build. And generation by generation, it would go up another level, higher and higher. Well, Chaucer, in writing the Canterbury Tales, undertook a massive task. We'll see when we get into the work. There are 29 pilgrims going on this pilgrimage. The deal that is set up by Harry Bailey, their host, he's the host of the Tabard Inn, where they gather, and he's going to lead them on the pilgrimage to Canterbury and back, is that each of the pilgrims, each of the 29, will tell two tales going to Canterbury and two tales coming back from Canterbury. And then they will decide who told the best tale, and that person will get a free dinner when they get back. I'll let you do the math yourself, okay? But what it means is Chaucer set himself an enormous task, an extraordinary number of tales to write, and he simply did not live long enough to complete it. However, there's also a bit of a mystery. Some think of necessity, I think deliberately, the whole nature of the work changes, even with the fragments we have. And what we do have of the work is the beginning and the end. So that we know where it starts, we know where it was going to end. What we're missing are chunks of the middle. And indeed, what we have at the beginning and the end, and let me go back to that medieval cathedral image, is the two massive supporting columns that hold up the entire work. On the front end, the knight's tale, the first of the tales to be told, and at the back, the very last tale to be told as they arrive in Canterbury, the parson's tale, which is a sermon. We have those two. We knew he intended to begin the work here, end it there. And what's interesting is that when the pilgrims arrive in Canterbury, there's no going back. They are not turning around and going back to where they came from. They are arriving in Canterbury, and we have a sense that that's their final destination, which means we've got to look in this work at Canterbury as an actual location on a map where pilgrims went in order to pay homage at the shrine of St. Thomas a Becket, and Canterbury as an image of the final destination of all pilgrims on all pilgrimages everywhere, and that pilgrimage is one way. There's no coming back. You reach that holy place and you're at your destination. You're not going to return. So the first thing I would say is that as you look or even think of the name Canterbury, think of it in those two ways. Think of it in those two ways. And I'll, let me do this just a little bit. Where do we begin? Clearly what I'm saying. Chaucer has designed the work to reflect every human life. Every human life. We begin in a worldly setting immersed in company, the affairs of this world, the pleasures and delights of this world, the problems of this world. If we're lucky enough to take that pilgrimage, we're going somewhere very specific. And what we'll find as the pilgrims begin, and we look at the 29, everybody in medieval England is on that pilgrimage. We have a type of all the types who lived in that society. They are chosen very specifically. Nobody gets left out. from the top of the society to the bottom, everybody's on the pilgrimage. Okay, so that it's a cross section. It's representative. Quite literally, they begin at the Tabard Inn, Harry Bailey's Inn. We're in London. We're in Southwark. Okay. They've gotten together, they've been there, they've had an initial dinner, they spend the first night and off they go, but we begin in the tavern. We begin in the tavern. Where are we going? We're going to the cathedral. Okay? This is not accidental. This is not accidental. In earthly terms, in terms of an earthly pilgrimage, it is pilgrims in England who are beginning in this place of pleasant surroundings, with a good meal and a few drinks, and then riding together to pay homage at the shrine of St. Thomas of Becket at the cathedral in Canterbury. On another level, we are beginning in the pleasures of the world and ending at that great cathedral where that is our final destination, and we will not return from there. That will be the resting place, and what we encounter there will be permanent. There will be no going back. We begin at a home. Harry Bailey lives in the inn, and he's good company. Harry Bailey is a portrait of a typical English tavern keeper of the time. He's concerned with all the worldly concerns. He knows the people around him. We are going to see him get into fights with a couple of the pilgrims. Okay, just we have all of that going on. That's absolutely typical. If you've ever been on a tour, the tour guide by the end of the tour is going to loathe some of the tourists. It happens inevitably. You know, make friends with some and hate others. Well, Harry Bailey, being the tour guide in a sense, does exactly the same thing. And there's one point where he nearly comes to blows with one of the tourists, with one of the pilgrims. And the knight has to intervene. Okay, it's a wonderful scene. We'll look at it closely. It's a hugely important moment in the longer shape of the poem. But we begin at Harry Bailey's home. We begin at home. And we're comfortable at home. We're familiar at home. And we're going someplace unfamiliar. And where are we going? We're going to a holy shrine. We may begin in familiar surroundings, but by the time we come to the end, we are going to be in a holy place. We are going to be in a holy place. We begin with fellowship. 29 pilgrims who do not know each other. They have gathered together. We have one father and son. We have a small group of religious that are going together. But basically we have individuals. They have gathered at the inn. They're getting to know each other. And the poem begins with idle chatter. Chit chat. If we decided we're going to take a bus to Chicago and we're going to tour Chicago and then come back and we opened it up to citizens of Winona, you'd find yourself seated on the bus with people you don't know. And as we headed down the road, you'd start to get to know them and it would be idle chit chat, just idle talk, getting to know those other people who are going with you. It's going to end with penance. It's going to end with penance and the author's retraction, where he apologizes for the work we've just read. Okay? We're going to end up in a very strange place. We're going to begin with idle fellowship and chit-chat, and we're going to end up with self-reflection. Who am I? What have I done? This is where I'm landing. This is my end. How will I make an accounting of myself? And it's particularly interesting because on the pilgrimage, we have Chaucer the pilgrim. I'm convinced he learned this from Dante. 6 years ago when I talked about the Divine Comedy, I made the point, and it's one of the keys to understanding the Divine Comedy. We have Dante the poet who wrote the entire work, and we have Dante the pilgrim who makes the journey through hell, purgatory, and heaven. Dante is a character in his own work. And you constantly have to keep in mind, you've got Dante the poet, the author, and Dante the character in the Divine Comedy. And boy, do you get that in the Canterbury Tales. Because one of the pilgrims is Chaucer. And when we get into the general prologue, I hope in just a few minutes, when we get into the general prologue, what you're going to see is, this guy is not very bright. It is absolutely one of the best jokes in the Canterbury Tales. is that the poet himself puts himself on the pilgrimage and is very critical of himself. As he starts out, he doesn't know a whole lot. He is falling for all sorts of misconceptions. And when it comes his time to tell a tale, he tells a tale that is so bad in such rotten verse that Harry Bailey stops him and basically says, no, you can't continue with this. That is just horrible. It's the first tale he tells. It's the tale of Sir Topaz, and it's written in doggerel verse. You have a great poet who's writing verse so bad it stinks. And it's so bad that Harry Bailey, who is no connoisseur of poetry, can tell it stinks, and he stops him. And then Chaucer tells a long moral story about Dame Prudence that is very pious and nearly endless. The tale of Melibee and Dame Prudence. It's worth reading. Don't put it at the top of the list. And it's almost as if Chaucer is now proving, oh, well, okay, I can tell you a nice pious little tale. And you just have the sense of the pilgrims dozing off as he goes on and on. Meaning, the author of the work tells the worst tales. They're just terrible. This is not accidental, because by the end, he is going to point out even deeper flaws in his own work. But by the end, when he comes to his retraction, he is going to have a full sense of himself as poet and man. What he must do on the pilgrimage is learn something about himself. And he does that as he travels. But when he begins, he is a comic character. But he's Chaucer the Pilgrim. I'll say more about him when we get to the general prologue. This is what we have then, this is the shape of it. And I want you to think of it, if you will, as simultaneously two works of art. It is our great source of information about medieval England, because we find out in it what they wore, how they talked, what they drank, what concerned them. So that in that sense, the Canterbury Tales functions in much the way that a great novel would. That is, specific details about lived life. One of the glories of David Copperfield is it tells you everything you need to know about 19th century Victorian England. You read David Copperfield, you have a sense of London in mid-19th century. The food, the drink, the talk, the people, what the streets were like. It's just, you get that in the Canterbury Tales better than anywhere else in medieval English. English literature. It's all there. And in that sense, it can be read as a delightful piece about these medieval pilgrims who are telling tales. But Chaucer was Catholic and profoundly Catholic. I'll try to prove that as we go along. And he knew that if we live in a natural world, surrounded by day-to-day activities and people who are chatting with us, and we live sun up to sundown, day by day, and are often concerned with worldly concerns. That's not why we're here. That's not what we're about. And there's that other pilgrimage that is going on simultaneously, just from this morning's prime, if you will. This hit me as you were chanting prime this morning. As the first prime of the workday week, it is the preparation for the week's journey. The antiphon at the outset presents a beautiful program for the coming days. Innocent hands, clean heart. You're not going to find that among the pilgrims. Some of them. Some of them, okay? The Psalms picture two processions. Psalm 23, the Ark of the Covenant being borne unto Mount Zion. The church is making the same kind of pilgrimage through the world, with Christ to the holy mountain of heaven. And it's very clear that Chaucer had in mind that deep, profound Catholic sense of pilgrimage. The church on a pilgrimage, and each individual member of the church on a pilgrimage. And just to make clear, he knew this, and this is where he was ending. Let me just read to you from the Parson's prologue. Don't worry, we'll look at it again later. I'll warn you, I'll say more about this in a moment. I'm going to do it in Middle English. I'll explain, but you'll get this. And Jesu for his grasa wit me sende, to show you the why in this viage, of thilka perfect glorious pilgrimage, that hicta Jerusalem celestial. And God give me the grace, says the parson, right before he begins his great sermon on the seven deadly sins, okay? Jesus, give me his grace, send me his grace to show you the way in this voyage of this perfect, glorious pilgrimage that is called celestial Jerusalem. That's the end point. They may go to Canterbury, but the parson knows very well the real end point is the celestial Jerusalem. Chaucer knew that's where they were ending. That's what the pilgrimage is. So we have these two things. We have the natural journey. We have the supernatural journey. We have the journey of the bodies of the pilgrims, and boy, are we reminded about the physical aspects of human life. We'll talk about the Miller's Tale tomorrow. But that is not the proper end. The proper end is indeed a spiritual end, because the body will die and decay, and at that point, the soul will stand in judgment. Once that high pilgrimage is ended, and he knows it, and that's where things are going. Let me explain the poetry a bit. This is tough. This is tough. I wrestled over this. There are two problems in trying to get copies of the Canterbury Tales. Number one, everybody cuts the Parson's Tale. If you get a modern edition, they will have junked the Parson's Tale. Basically meaning they are giving you this great, glorious, unfinished cathedral and knocking down one of the pillars. So even though Chaucer didn't finish it, the modern editors are destroying what he did get done. Because without the Parson's Tale, without that sermon, without that vision, if you will, at the end of movement towards penance and self-reflection, which is exactly what the Parson's Tale is about, you can't grasp this work. You can have no idea what it's about. I talked to some of my colleagues who teach Chaucer. That's their specialty. I asked them if they ever teach the Parson's Tale. Oh, no, you couldn't get students to read that. That's just a sermon. It's just boring. It goes on forever. But it's the but it's the end of the work, and it's there for a crucial reason. Oh, no. That's the end. Their vision is it sets it in time. The Parson's Tale, the sermon, anchors it in the Middle Ages. That's medieval. Medieval people could listen to that stuff. We've progressed. We've evolved beyond that. We don't need it. Say the modern academicians. Well, surprise. You know, it's they're on their own pilgrimage and are going to end up in some place they never dreamt they would arrive at. So, in any case, it's very difficult to find a complete Canterbury Tales with the Parson's Tale there at the end. This one at least gives a little summary of it and gives you the Parson's Prologue. So that's the first problem. Second problem is the decision of what do you do about language. Chaucer wrote in Middle English, not Old English. Old English is what Beowulf was written in. You've got to have a translation to read Beowulf. Old English is a Germanic English. It is a foreign language. I had a semester of it. I broke my brain trying to learn it. I translated passages of Beowulf, and none of it stuck in here. It's all gone. I pick it up. It's a foreign language. Middle English is exactly that. It's halfway between Old English and Modern English. Most particularly, Middle English has had that infusion of the French that came in 1066, okay, with the Norman conquest. And what happened then was that old Germanic language, English, got this huge, healthy dose of French Romance language. And the two combined to create this incredibly strange thing we call English that's half German, half French. And as a result, English has been the great language for poetry because they have twice as many words to use as any other language. There's this massive pool of words. Quick example. If you're German, you talk about Freiheit, freedom, and we have that word. If you're French, you talk about liberté, liberty, and we have that word. The Germans only have one word. The French only have one word. We've got two. That's true for almost everything. So that English has this enormous pool of language to draw from, and it's been a great playground for poets ever since. Because what poets revel in, words. Words are the poet's toys. And once you start playing with toys, and you like the toys, you never stop. What we have in Middle English is that infusion has taken place, and we have a Germanic-sounding language with lots of French in it. For centuries, it was assumed Chaucer was a barbaric poet with natural gifts and no poetic ear, because people didn't know how to read it. They didn't know how to scan the verse. And they thought it was impossibly ugly and rhythmically retarded, but it was so interesting you sort of had to read it anyway. Until the moment came when someone said, wait a minute, this stuff actually scans. This is iambic pentameter. What we now would call heroic couplets for the most part. Two lines of rhyme stanzas in iambic pentameter. Let me give an example. I'm at the very beginning of the prologue. If you want to look at you have a translation there. I will tell you what I'm going to be looking at, but I'm going to assault you with the original for two reasons. One, it doesn't take long before you get it in your ear and you can start doing it. When I took my first Chaucer course, it took me about 2 to 3 weeks. And the professor, God bless him, made us do it in the Middle English. And, you know, there were students dropping dead in the class and screaming and howling, not knowing what they were reading. And he just kept pushing. And then, of course, a good old professor, he made everyone in the class memorize the opening of the general prologue. And once you get some of it in your head, it's there. And then you can actually start, oh, yeah, oh, this makes sense. And then the sounds get in your head and the eye and the ear. You can do it. It takes a little bit of work. It's not that hard, okay? And I do want to get the original on the tapes so that poor homeschoolers out there, if you're listening to me in some future time, try it. It's fun. Think of it as a game, all right? So I will be doing a lot of the Middle English. But here's how they thought it originally went, okay? I'm just looking at the first four lines. When that operil with his shores soaked, the druked of March hath pursed to the rote, and bathed every vein in switch liquor, of which vertu engendered is the floor. Heaviness, hard, Germanic. The French isn't there. What happened, and I couldn't tell you who it was, somebody said, wait a minute. Some of these words are from the French. One that April with his shore is sota, the druked of March hath pursed to the rota, and bathed every vine in switch liqueur, of which vertu engendered is the floor. And it's pure iambic pentameter. And it's gorgeous. It is gorgeous stuff. You get this incredible mix of the hard German sounds with the delicacy and the lilt of the French flow. And Chaucer had a brilliant ear, an absolutely brilliant ear. And he wrote before what's called the great vowel shift, so that most of the vowels have slightly different sounds. And the hardest thing you have to do is just to sort of readjust the vowel sounds as you're reading along. Not too hard to do. Take a look, if you will. This is again in the general prologue. And I am here on page 7 in your book. It's the monk. We're being introduced to the monk, and I'll say more about him later. Bottom of page 7. In the translation, a monk there was, one of the finest sort who rode the country. Hunting was his sport. I'll comment on that. A manly man, to be an abbot able, many a dainty horse he had in stable. His bridle, when he rode, a man might hear jingling in a whistling wind, as clear aye and as loud as does the chapel bell. It's a wonder. He's out hunting. He's not in the chapel. And the jingling of the bells on the harness of his horse as he goes off hunting is as loud and clear and easy to hear as a chapel bell, which he's not hearing at all. he's not in the chapel praying, okay? If we take this and look at the original, and I'm doing this now just for the sound, just for the sound. A monk there was, a fair for the Maestria, an oat reader that loved Veneria, a manly man to bane an abbot Abel, for many a dainty horse had he in stable, and when he rode, men michte his bridle hera, jingling in a whistling wind als klar, and ache as lewd as doth the chapel bell. And all of a sudden with those vowel sounds, you hear the lightness of the jingling of the bells on the harness, and I just love it. And ache as lewd as doth the chapel bell. Ooh. I mean, you hear, it's a big bell in that chapel. And he's doing what a great poet does. He's creating the meaning with the sounds. Okay? A translation can't give you that. I remember the first time Harvard put out a translation of Shakespeare. These are becoming more common out there now. My favorite was this. The first one they put out was Julius Caesar. Antony's great funeral oration. He gets up into the pulpit, and of course in the original, friends, Romans, countrymen, lend me your ears. In the translation, friends, Romans, countrymen, listen to me. That was their modern translation. I mean, what you lose is incalculable. Antony kissing up to the crowd, lend me. Hey, we're friends. Can you lend me $5? Can you lend me your car tomorrow night? I've got it. Can you lend me your ears? Listen doesn't have the same thing as lend. Lend me your ears. Hey, take this in here. Shut your brains down. I'm going to appeal to your emotions, right? I want you to listen to me, but not your understanding, not your intellect. Just lend me your ears, okay? Listen to me. All gone. What they did is wipe out the character and wiping out the poetry. So, I apologize. You're going to have to put up with me making these grunting sounds, but I'll tell you where I am so you can follow along. And also begin to get a sense of what the sounds are like. They're glorious. I'm okay at it. I'm not great. You can get really good readers of Middle English. I'm not one of them. It's like my French teacher in high school told me, I'm the only person she ever knew who spoke French with a thick Norwegian accent. So this won't be perfect, but it, as I like to say, it's close enough for government work. That's what we say around the Naval Academy. You know. We're just government employees. That's close enough. So it'll be Middle English close enough for government work. Okay, okay. See, that's background, and now it's taken me 42 minutes. All right, we just move on. The general prologue. One of the most famous openings. Everybody used to have to memorize this. There was in my high school a dreaded senior English teacher. She was, again, unmarried, severe. People were terrified if they'd land in her class. And she always began by making the students learn the opening of the general prologue of the Canterbury Tales in Middle English. And, you know, they'd walk around the halls moaning and, you know, throw themselves off the roof of the high school. She retired the year before I took senior English. I didn't get it there. And just, it broke. I look back now, it breaks. I could have known it years before I got to college. We did it in translation. This is one of the most famous passages in English poetry. It's one of those that's so well known, it's easy to overlook what's going on. I will read the first 18 lines. Follow along if you can. If you don't have a book, see if you can find somebody just to look on with. Here you go. Yeah, so your ear will be hearing something different, but your eye should be able to get some of it. And then we'll talk about it. This is where our great pilgrimage poem begins, okay? Juan that April with his surest sota, the drucht of March hath pierced to the rota, and bathed every vine in switchly core of which vertue engendered is the floor. Juan Zephyrus ache with his sweeter breath, in spirit hath in every holt and haith the tondra croppes, and the younger sonna hath in the ram his half-course erona, and smaller fooles mocken melodia that sleepen all the nicht with open ear, so pricketh him natur in her courages. Than longen folk to gone on pilgrimages, and palmers for forsaken strange astrondes, to ferner hallways, couth in sondry londes, and specially from every shearer's ender of Engeland, to Canterbury thy wender, the holy blissful martyr for forsaken, that hem hath holpen one that thy were sake. It's gorgeous stuff. It's gorgeous. It's music. Poetry is verbal music. It's gorgeous stuff. Now, notice, what have we got? We have clauses that begin. And we've got a when clause, line one. We've got a when clause, line five, that leads us to a then clause in line 12. Okay? When this happens, when this happens, and this happens, then this happens. Okay? So that it's a very craftily designed opening sentence, and I would point out to you that is all one sentence. That is all one sentence. Where do we begin? We begin with the month of April. When that time comes in April, when April's sweet showers pierce the drought of March to the very root, okay? We begin with dead, dry earth. The winter has gone on into March, and earth is dead. Earth is dead. But suddenly come the spring rains, and those showers are sweet, and they don't just relieve the drought that has been March, they pierce it to the very root. And we have almost an image of impregnation because those waters bathe every vein of those dry, dead plants. Okay? The earth is pierced with this liquid, this fertile liquid that will bring life where there is emptiness and death. What do we have very subtly at the beginning? We have that word, hath persed. It's the end of March, it's April, and something's being pierced. We have an Easter image without him ever mentioning Easter. Because we're beginning in the natural world, but right from the start, there's the hint of a higher and more vivifying piercing. Just a hint of it. But it comes in that word. Hath pierced to the root and bathed every vein in such liquor, the virtue of which, I love it, it's a manly image, virtue coming from the root manliness, okay? The virtue of which engenders the flower. So we have that piercing, the liquid enters, and suddenly there's new life. It's an image of birth. It's an image of rebirth. It's an image of life where there's been death. But notice it's natural. It's nature. It's the water. It's the water flowing from heaven that does it. That makes it possible. Then we get a second thing. When Zephyrus also, there's something else. Zephyrus, the wind comes with his sweet breath. With his sweet breath. The wind is somebody's sweet breath, okay? Zephyrus simply meant the west wind. But the wind is not just wind, the wind is breath. If you have breath, you have someone breathing. When Zephyrus ache with his sway to breath, in spirit hath, in every holt and haith, the tundra cropes. Those small crops start coming up and the wind does what? It inspires them. And again, the word is not accidental. The wind is also coming from above, and it is quite literally breathing into. It is breathing life into those plants as they just begin to come up in the springtime. So we first have the water that pierces, a natural image. Now we have the vision of inspiration coming from above. We also have the opening of the poem, where traditionally every poet asks for inspiration from above. Chaucer won't say to the muses, inspire me to write my poem. His vision is the whole world being inspired by divine breath. Every spring as life is reborn. It's just a glorious image. Glorious image. And the young sun hath in the ram his half course irona. We have the sense, again, it was mentioned here in this morning's prime. I love it. The sun runs its course across the vault of heaven, like a hero, like a bridegroom, strong and jubilant. This is how we are to make our way through the week. And it's the vision of the young sun, again, not accidental words, rising up, moving across the heavens. And there, if you will, up above for everything to see and giving light. What do we have now? We have the rain that is engendering. We have the wind that is inspiring, and we have the young sun that is running in glory across the sky. It's and smaller fools machen Melodie, and those little birds start chirping. I just and now suddenly after this immense grand opening, we're back where just those little birds, smaller fula, I love it. And smaller fulas machen melodia, and little birds make song that sleepen all the nicht with open ear. They can't sleep it. It is so exciting. They are so full of life. They're singing all night. The birds woke me up this morning about 4:30. They were out there just chirping, having a great time, you know. They don't do that during the winter. They're not even there. They've headed out. This vision is, again, of all nature singing. What is the response to this? Nature itself sings in joy. That sleepen all the nicht with open ear, they can't sleep. Their eyes wide open. So pricketh hem nature in her courages. Okay? So nature incites them, moves their hearts and spirits. Well, part of it is, it's that time for mating. There will be more birds. It's another reason their eyes are wide open and they're singing. The birds are going to make more birds. And where we had the flowers coming out of the dead earth, we now have all of abundant life. We've had the flowers, we've got the crops, we've got the sun, now we have the birds, okay? So pricketh him nature in her courageous, but what have we left out? Man. When all of this is happening in the world around us, what is man doing? Van, longen folk to go on pilgrimages. It is glorious. The understanding at the beginning is not when all nature comes bursting back to life, man says to himself, I've got to go find me a mate. I've got to take my club, leave the cave. No. The notion is, given a world that is springing back to life, the renewal, the magnificence, the song, the glory, says to man, you better get moving on a pilgrimage. What you need to be thinking about is your soul. Is your soul. You are a part of that natural world. You live there in that nature. But at this moment when spring returns, it shouldn't be a reminder to you of the physical nature of the world. It should be a reminder to you of the glorious gifts of God which come from above that inspire you. And what they should inspire you to do is clean up your act now. If you will, be bathed in water, inspired by God. Face the sun. sing a great song of glory to God, you get going on a pilgrimage. Van longen folk to go on pilgrimage. It's beautiful. It's just beautiful. But, and palmers for to saken strange astrondes. We've got two things here, not one. We've got pilgrims and we have palmers. And the pilgrims who are inspired by the glorious outburst of spring long with a deep, profound interior yearning to go to God, to go to the holy place. And palmers, for to saken strange astrondes. Hey, let's go to Kenya on a safari this summer. We've never been there. Ooh, and then next year we can go to Antarctica and see the penguins. You've got two kinds of movers in the world who will go off. Those who have been properly inspired and are longing to go visit the holy shrine, and those who are joining up to see strange astrondes, strange places. I've been to Jerusalem. We're going to find out that the wife of Bath, woo, get ready for her. We're going to find out the wife of Bath has been to Jerusalem a number of times. It's not done her a lot of good. Okay? And she admits she goes in order to find yet one more husband. You've got these souls who are embarking, you've got the palmers who are embarking, if you will, on the same road, taking similar journeys, but they really just want to find new vacation sites. They want to see aspects of this world they haven't seen before. Never been to Finland, let's go and soak in the hot baths. What do you mean you haven't seen France yet? Oh, you have to see Paris before you die. It is, you know, it's my colleagues at the end of every school. Where are you going this summer? Well, we thought this summer that we would probably take a trip to Prague. We haven't seen the Czech Republic, and I hear it's quite beautiful. Oh yes, and right now it's quite inexpensive. Oh yes. Well, where are you going this summer? Well, we thought this summer we'd explore Latin America, of course. So we might go down to Argentina for a while. Oh, I've been there. It's just glorious. You'll love the beaches. It's so you can come back with your valise covered with medallions, okay? Been here, done that. I saw it, I'll show you my slides, okay? I got all my pictures of the Great Wall of China. I've got 70 slides of it. Come on over, I'll show you. Oh, please. But it's the notion of, hey, there's a big world out there to explore. And the palmers, and palmers for to saken strange astrondes. Meaning, there are two ways of pilgrimage. There is the proper pilgrimage. And they're called the pilgrims here. Those who are going because they long to go. They are at one with God's created world and they long to go. And there are the palmers who think, it's spring, I'm going to take a trip. I'm going someplace I haven't been before. It's going to be great. To understand the Canterbury Tales, you have to understand there are two ways. We're all following the same road. We're on the same pilgrimage. But there are two ways. There is the way that leads to the celestial city. There is the proper pilgrimage. There is the way that leads to the world. And we're going to see what that world is like. And let me just say now, and I'll explore it at length, the first two tales show us the two ways. The Knight's Tale, which is a vision of God's order and the higher way, and the Miller's Tale. And the reason the Miller's Tale is what it is because it is showing us the worldly way. If your eyes are directed to the world, then this is what you can expect. And in the first two tales, we get the two ways. Okay? I'll come back to that. Just got a little bit of time left. Let me finish up the first 18 lines. Oh dear. Well, it happens. To ferne hallways couth in sundry londes. Okay? They want to go to distant shrines that are known everywhere. You don't want to go to obscure shrines, so you come, if you're a palmer, come back and say, well, I went to see the shrine of Saint so-and-so and I've never heard of it. Where's that? Then you can't impress your friends. You want to go to those big fancy public ones. So everyone will say, oh, you went there? Oh, you went to Antarctica and saw the penguins? Okay? And specially from every shearer's end of England to Canterbury they wend. Okay? They're coming from all over England and they're all going to Canterbury. It's one road. It's one way. It's two different sets of travelers. The holy, blissful martyr for to Seca. Okay? They're going to seek out St. Thomas a Becket, who died, who was sacrificed, who was murdered for the faith at Canterbury, that hem hoth holpen, when that thy were sicka, sicka, okay? When they were sick in the winter, when they were diseased, when they were failing, they have prayed to St. Thomas and he has helped them. And now it is only appropriate that they go and offer thanks. But it's very clear by the time we end line 18, which group are we talking about? The pilgrims. The Palmers don't care. They don't know they're sick. They haven't had to ask for help from anybody. They're going along for the ride. And we end with those who are taking the worldly route just being dismissed. They're not mentioned again. If you will, they vanish. Although, boy, we're going to meet them in abundance as we travel the road. I'll go through more of the prologue in the second book.